Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 31st of August. This hour of the program, we remember the life of Senator Edward Kennedy.
It was only a few years ago on St. Patrick's Day when Teddy buttonholed me on the floor of the Senate for my support of a certain piece of legislation that was coming up for a vote. I gave my pledge, but I expressed skepticism that it would pass. When the roll call was over, the bill garnered the votes that it needed, and then some. I looked at Teddy with astonishment and asked, how had he done it? He just patted me on the back and said, luck of the Irish.
President Obama at the Mass for Senator Edward Kennedy that was held on Saturday. We decided to do our reminiscences today because many of you had a chance to see the incredibly moving eulogies that were delivered from both sides of the aisle at his wake on Friday night at the John F. Kennedy Library, and then the Mass on Saturday and the gathering of Senate staffers in Washington and the burial that took place in the dark, actually, on Saturday evening. We'll have two guests with us this hour, starting with Michael O'Brien. Michael spent 10 years writing a definitive book about John F. Kennedy, and that is the name of his book, John F. Kennedy. He's emeritus professor of history at the University of Wisconsin, Fox Valley. Jenna Russell will also be with us a little later, journalist for the Boston Globe and contributor to the definitive book, at least so far, about Senator Edward Kennedy, Last Lion, the Fall and Rise of Ted Kennedy. We welcome your phone calls, as we always do. 800-486-8655 is the number, 800-486-8655, for you to join our conversation. Michael O'Brien, long time no speak. Thank you so much for being with us.
How are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
Real good.
Good. I'm sure you had a chance to see a lot of the coverage over the weekend, and it was hard for me, as I'm sure many people who grew up in Irish Catholic families who really were drawn to the Kennedys, to not be very involved in this, to think about your grandparents and your aunts and your uncles and the Irish tradition and the Irish family and the place of politics in Irish families. It was more than watching the funeral of Senator Kennedy. To me, it was the Irish experience.
It was quite an educational experience to watch that.
Yes, it was, wasn't it?
Yes. Well, the Kennedys, Edward Kennedy and all the Kennedys were came from a large, wealthy Irish Catholic family, and their parents were very ambitious for their children. They were very ambitious largely because the parents thought they had been discriminated against in Boston, the Irish Catholics, and by God, they were going to show the Protestant Anglos that they could be as good or better than they were. So they had a system. Rose and Joe Kennedy really had a system. Not many parents have a system for raising their children, much less nine of them.
Right.
But they stressed the virtues of winning and competition and determination and perseverance, values later indispensable to the Kennedy boys.
Tell me about the differences and the similarities. You did this definitive work on John F. Kennedy. So much was said over the weekend of John being the one who didn't like to campaign very much, Bobby being the one who, you know, put his fists up occasionally, and Teddy being the hail fellow well met. What did they learn from each other? How did Teddy help create the lasting feelings and impressions that we have of both his brothers who were assassinated?
Well, first of all, he grew up in this very political environment. The parents stressed current events at the meals, and his grandfather had been, both grandfathers had been politicians in Boston, so he grew up with politics. Then Teddy watched his brother John and Robert in politics and learned from them. There were some differences among them. Robert Kennedy was the most religious of the boys. John and Edward were more, they were attended Mass on Sunday, but weren't as religious as Robert. Both Edward in his early years and John Kennedy and John Kennedy's father, Joe, were sexual philanderers. those were some of the comparisons.
Mm-hmm. And yet it would appear that, I don't know when this happened, Senator Kennedy did become rather devout with the illnesses of his children and these letters to the Pope that were divulged during the course of the weekend when he was asking for the Pope's blessing, I guess, for his previous transgressions and to bless him as he entered, as Senator believed, another life.
That was a very remarkable letter and response, but especially Edward's letter. Yes, in the last years of Edward's life, he became much more religious, attending daily Mass, partly at the time when his daughter was suffering from lung cancer, and maybe because of his own impending mortality. But he did become more religious at the end of his life.
Tell me about this urge. A lot of people have cited that it was of his own personal transgressions that he spent the latter part of his life, a good chunk of his life, in atonement. Do you think that's true, that he felt the weight of the Mary Jo Kopechne tragedy and his own carousing with his children and with others, womanizing, et cetera, that he had a transformation?
He did have a transformation. I have no doubt about that. And I do think he had a fair amount of guilt over the years. But there was a remarkable transformation. And I think one historian puts it very well in comparing him to his brothers. He was not a shining star that burned brightly and faded away like Robert and John. He had a long, steady glow. When you survey the impact of the Kennedys on American life and politics and policy, he will end up by far being the most significant. I think that's true. He had such a long career. John Kennedy, for example, was president for 1,000 days, and Edward was a legislator and senator for 17,000 days.
Goodness.
It's just a remarkable difference. And after he gave up his presidential ambitions in 1980 when he lost to Jimmy Carter, he in the Democratic primary, he concentrated for the next, 29 years on his legislative career. He ended up personally being the leader of about 30 pieces of legislation and was the co-leader of about 1,000 pieces of legislation. So it was a very significant last 30 years of his life.
I was also struck by everybody who talked about how generous this guy was, that he was the one to make the first phone call when you had suffered a loss, that he would take a cab, and we'll play a little bit of this story from Biden after Biden's surgery, up from Washington, and there he was spending 6 hours with him, attended all the christenings and the birthday parties and the patriarch of the family, and it was a huge family. You wonder how he had enough time to do all of that.
Well, I wonder, too. But that not only was extremely generous and I think extremely sincere, it was also political. In other words, he had an opponent like, let's say, Orrin Hatch, a very conservative Mormon minister from Utah. And yet when Orrin Hatch's mother died, John Kennedy and his wife, new wife, flew from Washington to Utah to attend the funeral, and Orrin Hatch was forever indebted for that. And he did that with many people, as you said. He did that for many people, and that not only was generous, it endeared him to them politically.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the moving eulogies came from Orrin Hatch on Friday evening at the Kennedy Library, and we wanted to play a little bit of this and then talk about that unlikely friendship.
Working in the temple and informed that the city would not allow a spire to be placed on the top of the temple with an angel on top of it, as is customary on Mormon temples. I immediately called Ted and asked for help. Not long after that conversation, he called me back and said, quote, "All of Western Massachusetts will see the angel Gabriel on the top of the Mormon temple." Though I was tempted to leave it alone, I had to inform Teddy there was actually the angel Moroni, a prominent figure in the LDS faith. And at that point, Teddy replied, "Does this mean I'm going to get another Book of Mormon for Christmas?"
That was funny, wasn't it, Professor O'Brien?
There were a lot of funny, statements. And Edward Kennedy had a tremendous wit about him, tremendous wit.
Tell me about the unlikely friendship and alliance between Senator Hatch and Senator Kennedy.
Well, again, I think it was partly the personal, the kind of thing that I mentioned to you, that Kennedy would go out to Orrin Hatch's mother's wake. But they seemed to, they were both longtime senators, so, and they were on the same committee. And I think Edward Kennedy approached Hatch, who was much stiffer than Edward Kennedy, and just befriended him. And then there were a few areas in which they could agree, like on health care for children. Children's health care insurance would be one area that they worked together. And when they didn't work together, when they were on opposite sides, they did so in a respectable manner, unlike some political opponents. So I think there was a friendship established, a respect established, a humorous relationship established.
Mm-hmm. I've never seen Hatch be quite so funny. He was funny that night.
He was funny that night. I don't think that's his natural nature, but he was funny.
Yeah. I read somewhere that Hatch had lost his only brother in World War II, so Kennedy became a late-life replacement for the brother he had lost. I'm wondering if you can also say the same about Hatch's role in Kennedy's life, that he became one of the brothers he had lost, perhaps Joe.
Well, I think that's possible. I hadn't heard that story, but I wouldn't be surprised that they talked about that and that they had that kind of relationship.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about his runs for the presidency. He was pressured by Mayor Daley, I know, in Chicago to run. He gave it some thought, and obviously you would. People would be pressuring him in many other years. Do you think that he had it in his belly to really want to be president, or he felt that it was an obligation to become president? What were his thoughts?
I think you hit it right on the head. I think he felt, first of all, an obligation to run for president after Robert died. I don't think he thought about it much until Robert died. And then there was a lot of pressure on him to run. There was the obligation for him to run, to carry the mantle of his brothers. I'm not so sure he really wanted to, but he felt that obligation. So he did run in 1980, but he didn't run a very good campaign. His speeches seemed wooden, and he didn't seem to have his heart in it. And after he lost to Jimmy Carter, I think he felt liberated from that role, certainly felt liberated from running for president and could concentrate on his legislative duties.
Mm-hmm. And what about his brothers? Joe died when he was very, very young, certainly, but what about the place of his brothers in Teddy Kennedy's heart?
Well, I think it was just the most traumatic experiences that he and the whole family went under. Joe Kennedy died in a plane crash in 1944 during the war. His sister Kathleen died in a plane crash in 1948. John dies or assassinated in 63. Robert assassinated in 68. John Jr. dies in a plane crash, and so on and so forth. And these were very traumatic for Edward Kennedy. I think the values that his parents instilled in him of determination and perseverance helped him through these terrible tragedies. But he made it through, and he made it through quite successfully, in my opinion.
Yeah. We welcome phone calls for Professor Michael O'Brien. Our number is 800-486-8655. We're talking about the life of Senator Ted Kennedy this hour. Michael has written a wonderful book on John F. Kennedy and obviously knows the Kennedy history. He spent 10 years working on a definitive book, John F. Kennedy, A Biography, is the name of it, published by Thomas Dunn Books, St. Martin's Press. And here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, that address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
But today I'm simply compelled to remember Ted Kennedy as my father and my best friend. When I was 12 years old, I was diagnosed with bone cancer, and a few months after I lost my leg, there was a heavy snowfall over my childhood home outside of Washington, D.C., and my father went to the garage to get the old flexible flyer, and asked me if I wanted to go sledding down the steep driveway. And I was trying to get used to my new artificial leg, and the hill was covered with ice and snow, and it wasn't easy for me to walk. And the hill was very slick. And as I struggled to walk, I slipped and I fell on the ice, and I started to cry. And I said, I can't do this. I said, I'll never be able to climb up that hill. And he lifted me up in his strong, gentle arms and said something I will never forget. He said, I know you can do it. There is nothing that you can't do. We're going to climb that hill together, even if it takes us all day. Sure enough, he held me around my waist, and we slowly made it to the top. And, you know, at age 12, losing your leg pretty much seems like the end of the world. But as I climbed onto his back and we flew down the hill that day, I knew he was right. I knew I was going to be okay.
Ted Kennedy Jr. at the Mass on Saturday. I thought his comments were just, you know, the dad, the humanity about him. His voice even sounds like a Kennedy, Ted Kennedy, in a way. It was something, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And I can see the influence of Joe and Rose Kennedy on that statement. That sounds like something Joe and Rose Kennedy would have told their children.
Hmm. To an extreme, do you think, at times?
To an extreme, yes. Hmm. Sometimes.
Right. Dave from Augusta, our first caller for you, Professor O'Brien. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning. What an amazing man Senator Kennedy was. I had met him twice in my life. Once he came to the high school I was at in 1972 when he was running for president, and he gave everybody a nice speech, and he met everybody afterwards. The second time was in 1993. I met him at St. Coletta's in Jefferson, Wisconsin.
Oh, yes.
I was making a delivery there, and I walked in, and I couldn't believe it was actual Senator Kennedy. He dropped what he was doing. He came over, and he shook my hand, and he says, "Nice to meet you, Dave." Huh. At first, I thought it was just the politician in him. But then I thought later on, you know what? He really cared to come over to meet a delivery driver. Just say hi and thank you and everything else. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, that was cool. Tell us about St. Coletta's. Tell us more of that. Rosemary staying there for most of her life.
Well, Joe Kennedy made a horrible mistake in 1941 when there was a lot of scientific discussion about the good effects of lobotomy. Most of that was mistaken. All of it was, in fact. But Joe Kennedy thought, well, this lobotomy would be good for his mildly retarded daughter. And he had it done, and she became much worse. And they then, shortly after that, put her at St. Coletta's, and she spent the rest of her life there. I think she died about 2005 or 2006. So it was a very sad and quiet chapter in the Kennedy family.
Mm-hmm. But Eunice, of course, kept close touch with her, and I understand that people from the Kennedy family used to visit her. I'm not sure how often, but they arrived under secrecy. They would come to Wisconsin to...
Well, I don't know if it was secrecy, but it was quietly.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of Eunice, she probably came more than anybody else.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for your call. Let's go to James next from Madison. Hi, James.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, how are you, James?
I guess one of my observations and comment about the Kennedy family, and I'd like for you all, commentator, to comment on this, that is, it appears as though he had a tremendous conviction of principles about what he believed and did not deviate from those. And I would like to know whether he knows about the historical origin of that. For example, whether it was Senator Edward Kennedy or President Kennedy, they stuck to their core beliefs. And I have been making an observation and contrasting this to the liberalism of Barack Obama, and I think a source of many of his problems. He does not appear to have conviction or core beliefs that he will not deviate from. And not to digress too far, for example, don't ask, don't tell policy. of Guantanamo Bay. Don't ask, don't tell. He gets there in the presidency. He hasn't done anything on that yet. I do not believe Teddy Kennedy or any of the Kennedys, once they got in the White House, they would have done what they said they were going to believe, come hell or high water. And that's a liberalism I don't think we see anymore. Mm.
Professor O'Brien.
Yes, I would agree partially with your caller, but partially disagree. The Kennedys were brought up on the principles of the Irish politician, Irish Catholic politician in Boston, which sought incremental improvements in the lives of their people, health care, food, things of that, jobs. And yes, they had core beliefs, but even John Kennedy did compromise quite a bit. And Edward Kennedy, yes, he had core liberal beliefs, but he was willing to accept incremental changes. If he couldn't get a big health care change, he would accept incremental changes, whether they were health centers throughout the United States or insurance for children's health or the Americans with Disabilities Act. He would take what he could get. And some would call it compromise, some would call it incremental improvements, and yet he maintained those core values of what he ultimately wanted to get, but what he couldn't get because of too much opposition.
And the breadth of the legislative areas that were of concern to him is so, it's a long list: civil rights, judiciary, refugees, social welfare, voted against the Iraq war, voting rights, job training, public education, the minimum wage, quality health care is a fundamental right, and the rights in lots of legislation related to the quality of health care.
Absolutely, a huge list.
It sure is a huge list. And I'm not sure if the Kennedy brothers, particularly John, I mean, he had to be, it's not as though he entered the presidency roaring with the fire in the belly to do something about civil rights in this country. It seems to me as though he ultimately did the right thing, but he had to be persuaded that this was the right thing. And events kind of took over, too.
Yes, absolutely. He had core values, but in some things he wasn't that progressive, like civil rights in the early part of his presidency. In the last 6 months of his presidency, he became a strong advocate of civil rights, and it was a matter of principle at that point.
And certainly Bobby was a strong supporter of civil rights.
That's right, and Bobby was. Bobby was not very interested in his Senate duties. He found it too slow for him. Edward Kennedy could be still motivated in Senate duties, but Robert was bored.
And why do you think Teddy obviously loved the Senate? What was it about that institution?
I'm not so sure exactly what it was about that institution that he loved. It's just that he was more motivated and more skilled at it than probably both of his brothers.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much, James, for your call. Scott from Sparta, hello.
Hi there. I would like to ask about a documentary that was out a few years back, and it was either on A&E or History Channel, one of those. And it made the case that what their conjecture was that what happened at Chappaquiddick was that Teddy and Mary Jo Kopechne left the party and went someplace to park, you know, as in making out to park. And a cop drove by. Teddy Kennedy panicked, told Mary Jo to drive, and he would walk back to town. And Mary Jo, not familiar with the area and the bridges with no railings and all that, had her tragic accident. And what the way they framed this was they cited people who were staying at the motel where Teddy was staying on the island, saying that they had seen him in the morning first thing, and he'd been bright and chipper and cheerful and talking. And then a couple of his aides came and arrived and they obviously broke the news to him. And after that time, they saw him again, you know, leaving with them, very agitated, very upset, just like a complete shift in his demeanor. And they made this case, and they said, you know, that that, in fact, he wasn't in the car, and they made a big mistake in what they concocted. But the reason that he left was because they'd been drinking, and he didn't want to get caught in a compromised position by a police officer.
Hmm. Professor O'Brien.
Yes, I don't think that that's true. I think that's one of the many mythical stories told about the Kennedys. There was a very good book about from his best friend who explained what happened. And no, I don't think Mary Jo Kopechne was driving the car. I think he was driving the car. And, of course, it turned out to be horrible for his career, the fact that he appeared to be drinking, the fact that he appeared to drive off the road with Mary Jo Kopechne and wanted to have a sexual affair with her on the beach. And then when she drowned, it wasn't until 10 hours later that he called the police. All of this resulted in tremendous antipathy for Kennedy, some of which still remains today. I might add that this is a good opportunity to explain why some people, probably a large minority of people, can't stand Edward Kennedy. Chappaquiddick is number one. His drinking is another one. But they also, critics don't like the fact that he was a stereotypical liberal. And by that they mean a big government supporter, mm-hmm. a big spender. And so this large minority would never forgive Edward Kennedy, and they would make him the whipping boy of modern liberalism.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was a sure a big presence in this country for a long, long time, wasn't
yes.
he? Big presence.
There's one interesting quote I wanted to read.
Yes, please.
In the course of the last few days, I thought it was kind of a beautiful quote. It says that most people grow up and go into politics. The Kennedys go into politics and then they grow up.
It's a good quote.
Yeah.
Professor O'Brien, a great pleasure to speak with you again. I would imagine people can still get your book, right?
Well, certainly they can,
okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Professor Michael O'Brien, his book is John F. Kennedy, A Biography. It's a book that he spent 10 years working on, and you can tell that that amount of effort went into this. It is published by St. Martin's Press and highly recommended. We're talking about the life of Senator Edward Kennedy this hour of our program, welcoming your phone calls and your reminiscences. 800-486-8655 is the number, 800-486-8655.
The work goes on, the cause endures. The hope still lives, and the dream shall never die. I have lived a blessed time. Now, with you, I look forward to a new time of aspiration and high achievement for our nation and the world.
My brother was the first president of the United States to state publicly that segregation was morally wrong. His heart and his soul are in this bill. If his life and death had a meaning, it was that we should not hate but love one another. We should use our powers not to create conditions of oppression that lead to violence, but conditions of freedom that lead to peace.
Those of us who loved him and who take him to his rest today pray that what he was to us, what he wished for others, will someday come to pass for all the world. As he said many times in many parts of this nation, to those he touched and who sought to touch him, some men see things as they are and say why. I dream things that never were and say why not.
The Kennedys are not in public service to make money. We have paid too high a price.
Joining us now, as we remember Ted Kennedy, one of the contributors to Last Lion, The Fall and Rise of Ted Kennedy by the team at the Boston Globe. It is the definitive work on Ted Kennedy, and our guest is Jenna Russell, a journalist for the Boston Globe and contributor to this book. We'll welcome phone calls for Jenna. Again, our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Hi, Jenna. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Kathleen. It's great to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you here. So of all the coverage, the mass and the wake and the Senate staffers, et cetera. What memories will you carry with you from this weekend particularly?
Well, there are quite a few things that I'm sure I will remember, but I think one of the most striking will be the motorcade, the senator's last departure from his beloved Cape Cod, and the motorcade from Hyannisport to Boston on Thursday, where the route was lined with thousands of people, constituents who came out to wave flags and hold their hands over their hearts and bid a final farewell to the senator. It was a pretty remarkable scene, a remarkable outpouring.
Mm. And tell me about that outpouring, Jenna. Was it for his generosity? Was it for the tragedies of the family? Was it for redemption? What was it?
Well, it's a lot of those things, and it's a long, complex history that the voters here in Massachusetts have with the senator, of course, going all the way back to his brother's presidency in the 1960s and the aura of romance and idealism of that Camelot period that really descended down through the line to Senator Kennedy and always kind of surrounded him and his family. But I think the thing when you talk to people, the thing that is very striking and almost unbelievable are the number of regular folks, average Joes, who have a personal story to tell about reaching out to him and his staff for help with some need, sometimes, you know, a life or death situation, needing medical care and not being able to afford it, but also, you know, much smaller stories are out there, you know, of even, I think, a woman who was struggling to get her mail delivery in a timely fashion. And time after time, with an attention to detail that is really hard to imagine, he responded to these people and helped them with their problems in a way that really forged an incredible connection.
Mm. Endearing yourself, it does, to your constituents if you function that way, right?
Yeah, absolutely so. And by all accounts, he has hired great staff over the years, and they deserve, I think, a lot of the credit for that responsiveness.
Right. The other thing that was so striking to me, and I've talked about it earlier today, is the fact that this guy had such a warm heart. All of the stories, the eulogies that were given on Friday night, some of them were hilarious. Culver's story about going sailing for the first time just had me in stitches. I'm a sailor who's not very good myself, but I've had exactly the same kind of instances where I'm yelling at people and do all these things, and they don't know what it is. And, oh, my gosh, it was funny. He was generous, and he was so warm and asked people to go on these adventures. They weren't ready for many of them with him, but they said, okay, I'll come along.
Right. He, you know, obviously raised in a way where the adventurous spirit was prized and valued and really expected of the children and the family. And, you know, famously being taught to swim by his older brother who threw him into the ocean off the coast of Cape Cod. And he, you know, he kind of expected other people to rise to that kind of spirit. And because he was, as you say, such a warm, forgiving kind of person, I think people were able to go along with him and sort of do things that they probably wouldn't have done or maybe regretted doing later.
Oh, they made for really good stories later. They probably said it was okay. You write in the book that he had become so associated with family moments of grief, and that grief was profound, that he grew into a living symbol of perseverance amid loss, as famous for his aching eulogies as for his dreams shall never die political exhortations. How true that is.
It's really true, and I think it's hard. It was hard for me in working on the book, you know, as someone who wasn't born at the time of the assassinations, to look back and really understand how much people here in Massachusetts and also Kennedy supporters around the country really suffered with this family through these tragedies. And grieved for them. And I think for me, one of the most interesting discoveries in doing the book was because I was assigned the task of writing about Chappaquiddick. And one of the big questions, of course, is, well, how could the voters in Massachusetts forgive that and continue to reelect Ted Kennedy to the Senate. And I think what I came to understand was that they were so invested in this family, you know, because they were Catholics, because they were Irish, because they were from Massachusetts, that they just were not almost willing or able to let go of that connection. And I think that's one of the reasons that, they were able to stay with him even through that, episode.
Mm-hmm. What about this? The book describes, and I'm wondering what you think about this, the disintegration you write, I don't know if you wrote this, but one of the contributors did, of Ted's personal life continued after Chappaquiddick, actually, for a quarter century. All of his weaknesses, the drinking, possible drug use, you know, the womanizing, et cetera. And it appeared that his story was all over but the telling, but it was his fate to live out his years repeating the pattern of periodic legislative success and personal disappointments. But there was another act to come. And was there ever another act to come? I think that's one of the other things that draws us to this story. He meets Vicky. He has some legislative successes. He's the lion and the liberal of the Democratic Party. People love him even from opposite sides of the aisle. He's resurrected in a sense.
Yeah, part of what makes him such a fascinating character and such a natural center point for a book is that he does have almost these two sides. And throughout the 70s and into the 80s, when his marriage was falling apart, his drinking was increasing, the womanizing was becoming an issue, it's really astonishing to note how much he was even getting done legislatively at that time. You know, bringing home the briefcase full of papers every night and somehow being productive even while he was sort of spiraling out of control. But then certainly when he meets Vicky Reggie, it's a huge turning point for him, and he acknowledged himself that, you know, she almost kind of saved him. And, you know, I think that the power of that relationship has been so much on display this weekend, with her taking the leading role in the grieving, very public role, and her graciousness in coming out and talking to the mourners and thanking them for their support. I think we've gotten a better idea these past few days of sort of what it is about her that was so appealing for him.
Right. We'll take phone calls for our guest. If you'd like to join Jenna Russell, journalist for the Boston Globe, contributor. I'm sure some of you have had a chance to read this book. We spoke about it when it was released with the editor. Last Lion, The Fall and Rise of Ted Kennedy. And, of course, contributors to the book have been all over television during the course of the wake and the funeral mass and the burial. Jenna is a journalist for the Boston Globe and contributed to this book. As she said, the Chappaquiddick incident, which was probably one of the more tough assignments she dealt with, and also whether or not he had deep presidential ambitions or not. So join our conversation if you'd like it. If not, just listen. And if you want to send an email, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. This is Joe Biden with another one of those stories about the warmth and generosity of Senator Edward Kennedy.
You know, I was sitting in Wilmington, Delaware, after recuperating for 6 months from two cranial aneurysms and a major embolism, and kind of feeling sorry for myself. And all of a sudden, up my old dusty driveway comes a cab, and out jumps Teddy Kennedy. And he had a picture frame under his arm. It was about 2.5 by 3 feet. And I was sitting by a pool, and he walked over, and he said, "Where can I change?" And he had a bathing suit with him. Put on his bathing suit, came back out, and he said, "I want to give you this." And he gave me this picture of a big Irish stag. And he said to my Irish chairman, "Come back. I need you." He sat there for 6 hours with me.
And you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jenna Russell is our guest, and she is a contributor to Last Lion, The Fall and Rise of Ted Kennedy by the team at the Boston Globe. She is a writer for the Boston Globe. Our number, join us if you'd like, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 for you to join our conversation. Jenna, it is remarkable when you go down the list of the legislative involvement and legislative achievement of this man in the Senate and the length of his service, the breadth of his service. It's so substantial, isn't it?
Yeah, it's. I think that's what, you know, that's why when people ask, well, why are we, you know, what is this excess of coverage of this man's death, and is this over the top, and why have we elevated him to the stature of almost a president? I think, you know, what it boils down to is the length of his service, which is remarkable, and then you almost can't overstate the number of lives that he touched with the legislation that he pushed forward for decades, and literally going back to his earliest years in the Senate. You know, to everything from the sweeping protections for disabled people in the Americans with Disabilities Act to Head Start and the SCHIP program for poor children to, you know, his co-sponsorship of the ERA, his work on the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, campaign finance reform, and giving 18-year-olds the vote. And yeah, it's a list that's so long that you every time you read it over, you discover something that you had forgotten about or not realized his role in, and you're astonished once again at how productive he was and how successful.
Yeah. And tell me, because I know you contributed this to the book as well, about the calls for him to run for the presidency, his reluctance to do so because he was suffering such grief from the loss of Bobby and from John, and why it was that he found the calling in the Senate. Tell us both those stories.
Right. Well, almost, it's kind of amazing to imagine now, but almost as soon as his brother Robert was killed, the push was on to get him to step in and take over for him. And, of course, he realized at that time in the immediate aftermath of the assassination that he was in no shape to take on a run for the presidency. And at the time of the accident on Chappaquiddick, he was in a real spotlight as far as what his plans were to run in 1972. There was just unrelenting speculation about that in the press, and I think it was, you know, already becoming obvious to him that this was not going to let up. He did, however, and again, I was stunned to figure out how quickly that speculation resumed after Chappaquiddick. You know, after a brief faltering period,
yes,
people stepped right back in, calling him the Democrats' greatest hope to regain the White House. He did not run in 1972, and I think attributed it to family reasons and also feeling like he wanted to pursue his work in the Senate. But no doubt, I think his advisors felt like it was too soon after Chappaquiddick and that it would be best to wait. I think the more surprising decision was his deciding not to run in 76, when a lot of people really thought that he would. But he had, you know, he had stepped up. He had become a father figure to all of those fatherless nieces and nephews who needed him. Some of them were going through some tumultuous times of their own. He had his own son, Teddy Jr., who had suffered through cancer, had lost a leg, and whose prognosis was not totally certain yet at that time. And so he did. He really did have some pressing family issues that would cause him to defer. And at the same time, I think you make the point well, that the longer he spent in the Senate, the more he realized how much could be accomplished there, how good he was at the work he was doing, and how satisfying it was to him. And a lot of people close to him acknowledge that they feel like by the time he did run for president in 1980, that it was really the fire wasn't in the gut. It was he did not have the burning ambition to become president that you perhaps need to make it, to get the job. And I think that probably made it easier for him after he failed in his run to accept that his career would be in the Senate, a place where he felt comfortable and where he was establishing an increasing track record of success.
Right. Well, it is pretty easy to understand why you wouldn't have the fire in the belly when you've seen, I mean, this is such a profound thing. Two brothers assassinated.
Right. And you know, you can talk about that all you want, and certainly people have, but I don't think anybody on the planet can actually really understand what that feels like except the Kennedys. And he was, after their assassination, he was receiving more death threats on a weekly basis than anyone in the country except for the president and the vice president. He had constant Secret Service protection. There are numerous stories of him, you know, walking around Washington and hearing a car backfire and just flattening himself on the pavement. And this was just something he lived with day to day. But that's not to say that it didn't really take a toll and really factor in his decisions, especially where he's standing there as the patriarch of this family with all these kids who are looking up to him for support. And I don't think it's unreasonable to imagine that he would think hard about that.
Right, of course. Tell me a little bit more about Vicky. First, do you have any thoughts that she may indeed take this position, at least until the special election? And two, what was it about the two of them? Much has been made of this love story that helped him get through, and people like it. So I want to hear more about her.
Mm-hmm. She, as to her running, I don't think we've heard anything yet that would suggest that she's seriously considering stepping into his seat. I think at the moment more of the speculation centers on his nephew, Joe Kennedy III. And that's not to say, though, that she wouldn't find considerable support, especially after these last few days when she's had such a public role and I think garnered so much sympathy here and around the country. Their families had been friendly for a long time, and they had kind of known of each other. But at the time when they met and fell in love, Ted had gone to her parents' home for a dinner party, and she answered the door. And I think her personality is kind of captured by this anecdote that one of my colleagues collected for the book about how she answered the door, and there was, you know, Senator Kennedy standing there on the doorstep by himself, and she kind of wisecracked to him, what's the matter? Couldn't you get a date? And it's kind of a great, great moment to imagine, and I guess he probably wasn't expecting that,
but
his sense of humor and his kind of love of the irreverent, it's understandable how that probably endeared her to him right at the start. And they talked, you know, reportedly they talked a lot that night, started to get to know each other, started to spend a lot of time together. And she was very taken with his embrace of her two children. There's a great story that's in the book that my colleague Joseph Kahn reported about how she, you know, one night they were hanging out at her house and her children kept calling for her upstairs and she kept disappearing to go take care of the children. And she came downstairs at one point and apologized to him. And Senator Kennedy said, don't ever apologize for that, Vicky. You know, there's no more beautiful sound, I'm paraphrasing, than that of a child calling for its mother. And I think that, you know, It meant a lot to her that he was so supportive of the children and willing to embrace them as his own.
Right. Oh.
But she was definitely she's a woman who was you know, very smart, a lawyer, very accomplished in her own right, very politically aware. in many ways a good match for this very accomplished man.
Mm-hmm. Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens with her in the months ahead. The other thing that really permeated, in addition to sadness, but the humor. You know, Orrin, I've never seen Orrin Hatch as funny as that. I've never seen Orrin Hatch be really funny. He was really funny, wasn't he?
He was quite funny. Yeah, they apparently have just a really interesting relationship.
Yeah.
That my colleague Susan Milligan reported on. Very unlikely relationship, and yet clearly seeing, you know, the emotion that was coming through on Friday night, just a true, for all of its political oddities, a very true friendship and a real sense of mutual support there.
Right.
And it's pretty interesting.
Yes, it's extremely interesting. Thank you, Jenna, so much for being with us. I know you must be tired after the weekend, but the book is the definitive word on Senator Kennedy, and it's great to read, too. Thank you.
Well, I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Jenna Russell, she's a journalist for the Boston Globe and contributed to Last Lion, The Fall and Rise of Ted Kennedy. It's by the team at the Boston Globe. It was published just recently. It's all over the place now, of course. Simon & Schuster, the publisher of this. Okay, everybody. Well, that's that for today. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for doing a lot of production work for this program, producing the show and sound clips as well. Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. I'll be with you again tomorrow at 9 o'clock on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.